TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked on September 11. An interview with the author, Nafis Mossadegh Ahmed, by Jeffrey Blankfort, Part 1. Very soon after the events of 9/11, questions were raised about the fact that no planes were sent up to intercept the hijacked planes, and about the insider trading of airline stocks right before the 9/11 attack, about the person of Mohammed Atta, and the role of the Pakistani intelligence service. Relatives of some of the victims of 9/11 and members of Congress demanded an independent inquiry. Vice President Cheney's resistance raised more questions. The November 2002 appointment of Henry Kissinger to head the Commission of Inquiry is considered a scandal by his longtime critics and raises even more questions. What did the Bush administration know about the preparation of the 9/11 attack, and when did they know it? Nafis Mossadegh Ahmed is the executive director of the British-based Institute for Policy Development Research. His book, The War on Freedom, is the most comprehensive effort yet to explore these questions. The interview with Mr. Ahmed was conducted by the journalist and talk show host Jeff Blankfort on his program on the Mendocino County Community Station, KZYX. He reached Mr. Ahmed in his home in England. Here is Jeff Blankfort.
In your book, you refer to a plan outlined by Zbigniew Brzezinski for the Council on Foreign Relations, a plan that for the U.S. to dominate the globe, beginning with Central Asia. This has been amplified by a Pentagon and other Washington think tank documents that have been, say essentially the same thing that have recently come to light. Brzezinski referred to the need for an external threat in order to convince the American public to come along with the struggle of the U.S. to take over the globe. Was 9/11 the trigger for that, and is Iraq the next step?
I think that as a matter of historical record, it's very clear that 9/11 paved the way for a new militarized foreign policy, which has involved projecting American power into Central Asia and beyond. And it's quite interesting to see that the planning for the military operations that are now being conducted, as you hint at, was actually done prior to the 9/11 attacks. And much of this planning was actually very detailed and very extensive. And you referred to a think tank document which contained a lot of this planning. And there is on the record a great deal of this evidence. I mean, I think the document you were referring to was a study done by a think tank called the Project for a New American Century.
That's correct.
And this was kind of like a neoconservative think tank. And they did a study prior to Bush actually coming to power. I think it was in September 2000 they actually did it. But it was commissioned by Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Bush's brother Jeb, and I think one or two other top administration officials. Basically, we had these top government officials who had commissioned this study, which basically contained what I would describe as the intricate details of where they want to go in the world, why they want to go there. And they talked about regime change in Iraq and the need to get an American force within the Gulf region, transcending the issue of Saddam Hussein, which very clearly talks about how the reason for going into Iraq is not really to do with whether Saddam Hussein poses a threat or not, but simply to do with broadening the strategic, geostrategic control of the United States. This is really, it's referred to quite explicitly in this particular study. It really literally talks about a global Pax Americana. And then there also are a number of other documents which have been released over the years since the 1990s, known as the Defense Planning Guidance series of documents. And These really have been primarily authored by Dick Cheney, although There has been input from many other defense officials. And if we analyze those documents, we can see a general thread which has evolved with time, talking about the need for the United States to establish its global preeminence and to prevent any other rivals from challenging American power or even aspiring to a greater role in world affairs. And basically, this whole grand plan is what is actually happening now under the guise of the war on terror. And 9/11 did provide the pretext and the trigger for the administration to carry out this plan.
I was just to define that Jeb Bush was a part of this document in its planning stages, and we don't hear that much of him, but the role that he played in his brother's election in Florida, our quote-unquote election in Florida, seemed even more significant, for without George W. Coming to power, we probably would not have seen this implemented.
Oh, yes, definitely. I think it is very important to look at the role of the Bush family in general, because Jeb Bush was also known to have signed an executive order, I think it was on 7th September, which is just 3 days prior to the attacks within Florida, because obviously Jeb Bush is the governor of Florida. And the executive order he signed was to implement martial law in the case of a national emergency, which would obviously lead us to ask what prompted him to take such measures. What information did he have available to him which inspired him to prepare for an emergency just 3 days before the attacks? It really is a bit strange when we connect these different bits of data together and we start consistently finding the involvement of the same key players.
Bush promised to smoke out Osama bin Laden, but numerous documents contained in your book indicate a far different relationship between the Bush family, and Osama bin Laden, the bin Laden family, and the Carlyle Group, kind of a mysterious Carlyle Group whose name keeps emerging and has a number of old-line administration players in it who are making huge profits off of Carlyle investments. Perhaps you could go into that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Carlyle Group is basically a giant investment company which is also heavily involved in defense-related industries. And they have on the board of Carlyle, there's a very large number of former government officials, and including the father of the current president, the former president, George Bush. And it's worth noting that Carlyle also has a relationship to the bin Laden family. The bin Laden family, prior to 9/11 and just after 9/11, had a very large investment in, I think, about several million dollars worth in Carlyle. Of course, basically, I mean, many analysts have basically come out and called into question that the very fact that we have George Bush, on the one hand, whose father is involved in Carlyle, connected to the bin Laden family, who obviously are connected to Osama in a loose way at face value. And people have basically said, well, this is a very strange relationship. And then obviously we also have the damage control, which has come out and with people saying, well, you know, it's not really a strange relationship. The bin Laden family, there's nothing suspicious about them. They've broken away from Osama. And you know, what's wrong if the president is involved with Carlyle? And we can basically take on these propositions one by one. I'll deal first with the issue of the president's father being on Carlyle. There's one organization, Judicial Watch in Washington, which questioned the ties between Carlyle and the government through the president's father, simply because Carlyle, being a defense, heavily involved in the defense industry, would have made a vast amount of profit from the war in Afghanistan and from the whole war on terror, which has involved a whole new horizon for the U.S. military in terms of defense expenditure, weapons technologies, etc., etc., which obviously means that as a result of the decision of the current president, his father, who works for Carlyle, would potentially be making profit too, which essentially means that Bush is profiting the Bush family is profiting directly from the current policies of the administration, which is obviously a conflict of interest. And taking it further, we also have this situation where the Bin Laden family, who have an investment in Carlisle, are also profiting from the same situation. Now, this whole strange relationship takes on a whole new light when we look at evidence that suggests that the Bin Laden family hasn't really broken away from Osama. I mean, obviously, officially, we've been told that Saudi Arabia has prevented, frozen Osama's funds and has prevented him from accessing his inheritance from his from the company which he used to be with, which is originally from Osama's father. And according to the reports that we have from various intelligence agencies, this money is actually being made available to Osama through his family, members of his family, and ironically on what they believe to be religious issues, because they believe it's religiously, from the Muslim point of view, incorrect to do that. And that's why they're saying, well, that's why we have to give them the money, which, of course, is a justification for funding terrorism. Once we start looking at that, we can basically see very clearly that the financial relationship between the Bin Laden family and the Bush family through Carlisle actually is connecting the U.S. government potentially directly to the funding of Osama. And I think the whole thing becomes even worse when we look at what happened a couple of days after September 11th. And there are conflicting reports on this, but what is certain is that members of the Bin Laden family in the United States were whisked out of the country on a private jet under the supervision of the FBI. And this was reported by CBS News and a couple of other news agencies in the American and British press. So we have this FBI operation, which has obviously had high-level government approval, because according to some reports, the day when the plane was actually flying, carrying these members of the Bin Laden family out, was when there was a block on planes being flown in the United States at all. So there is no doubt that this operation of shifting out members of the Bin Laden family was conducted by the FBI with high level government approval. And once we take all these little bits of data and kind of connect them together, we then can see that this overall picture of what I would say is almost complicity.
Well, actually, in your book, you go even beyond that. You point out both the Clinton and Bush administrations were given opportunities to extradite Bin Laden, Clinton from the Sudan, and Bush from Pakistan without a war or loss of life, but in each instance, the U.S. government refused.
There are quite a few such instances. I mean, I think one of the most notorious ones actually occurred in the Sudan, when Osama bin Laden went to Sudan, and he was being heavily monitored by the government there. And many, many times, the Sudanese administration offered the Clinton administration to hand over these files on Osama, which obviously contained extensive details on the nature of Bin Laden's network, how it was operating, who was a part of it, what they were planning, and et cetera, where they were hiding out, and so on and so forth. And they didn't just offer it to the Clinton administration. They actually also offered it to British intelligence, and both the responses of the American and the British authorities was simply to say, no, we don't want this. And there was also the issue of actually extraditing Osama, and there was the possibility that as a result of the Osama's role in previous terrorist attacks, there was this keen interest on the part of U.S. intelligence agencies of actually apprehending Osama. And since the Sudan actually knew where he was and had a track on him, many people thought, why don't we exploit that and actually get a hold of this guy? And what actually happened is that although there was this pressure from what I would say were the more sincere parts of the intelligence community to actually apprehend Osama, the administration actually turned down many repeated offers from the Sudanese government to hand Osama over to the United States, literally just hand him over. The United States gave various alternative offers to the Sudanese administration, saying, why don't you just let him go to Afghanistan and that will be it? And the response of the Sudanese government was, well, look, if we just let him go to Afghanistan, then we won't know what he's doing anymore because we've been monitoring him. We've got our files. You don't want our files. The United States government literally just said, it doesn't matter, just do what you have to do, but we don't want him. The pretext for that that has now come out is that they didn't have enough evidence at that time to be able to actually convict Osama of involvement in the previous terrorist attacks, for example, in Yemen. They said that if we take him to the United States, there won't be any point because, you know, we put him on trial and then he'll just get released and it will just be this. In fact, it will work for him because the evidence won't be good enough. But it turns out that we have testimony from the late John O'Neill, who was a former deputy director in the FBI. And according to many people in the FBI, he was one of the most hard-nosed leading anti-terrorist investigators. And he was involved in the investigations into the Al-Qaeda bombing in Yemen. And he actually went there with an entourage of FBI agents to investigate what happened. And he testified specifically, he's been quoted in a book called The Forbidden Truth. And he's also been quoted in a couple of other press reports which have cited his interview with the authors of that book. But he basically said that my investigations into Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Yemen were blocked by the State Department, consistently and repeatedly blocked. We were not allowed to access evidence of his involvement, and that is what has prevented us from gathering the evidence and being able to say now we can get Osama and we can actually indict him properly and, you know, put him on trial and put this evidence on the table. And he was furious about this, and he talked a whole load about how the U.S. government and the State Department and various other agencies have consistently been blocking terrorist investigations into Al-Qaeda. It's very clear, basically, that this is a result not just of some kind of bungling incompetence, but out of a systematic policy. And I think that is perhaps most clearly indicated by a statement from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, who came on CNN. I can't remember when now. I think it was at the beginning of this year. He came on CNN and they were asking him about how come we haven't found Osama? You know, does that mean that this war on terror is a failure? And then he commented in response to that, this has never been about trying to get Osama. And which is obviously quite, when you think about it, it's quite a shocking statement because, you know, we've been told, you know, that the whole thing was about Osama. I mean, President Bush, as you said, was saying that we want him either dead or alive and we're going to smoke him out. And then you have Myers coming out and saying, well, it's never been about trying to get Osama, never. You know, then it makes you question, well, if it's never been about trying to get Osama, what has it been about? Has it never been about trying to get Al-Qaeda? I can't believe this administration anymore. I can't believe these officials because they, you know, obviously someone somewhere is lying. And, you know, looking at the policy, tying it all together, it's very clear. Al-Qaeda, they have tolerated the existence of this terrorist organization in order to co-opt it and allow it to pursue various operations which may fall within U.S. interests.
Exactly. This is a conclusion I've reluctantly come to. Speaking of Richard Myers, in your book you point out as a part of the failure of standard operating procedures to function when the World Trade Center and the Pentagon was attacked, the lackadaisical reaction of Myers to the attack. Perhaps you could discuss that.
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, on 9/11, we had four planes within the space of about 20 minutes in the early hours of the morning, which were hijacked. Basically, there was absolutely no response on the part of the authorities in terms of actually scrambling military jets to respond to these four planes which were hijacked and flying around over U.S. airspace for about 1.5 hours. Until after the Pentagon was hit. And we should put that in context with the fact that it's completely normal procedure to basically scramble military jets in response to these kind of emergencies. And we can talk about that in a little bit of detail. The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Department of Defense have a number of manuals which are read by pilots and air traffic control and everyone, and basically just manuals which tell them how to do their job. And those manuals, we can read it online. There's a website, faa.gov, which does have a couple. I think it has most of them online, actually. And if people go look, they can find them there. And these indicate that there are a whole array of basic procedures to deal with what happens when there's a plane in the sky, and how to deal with various things. And among those things are what would be considered possible emergencies and full-scale emergencies. And one such possible emergency is, say, we have a plane, a commercial plane, which is it has a fixed flight path, and what happens is that the plane is not allowed to deviate from that path. It's all very set and planned, so that the air traffic control can make sure that there's no danger of planes flying into each other or anything like that. So when the plane flies off its flight path if something goes wrong or something like that, then air traffic control, of course, which is monitoring the skies all the time, will basically try to establish contact with that plane to find out what's going on. Why is it deviated from its flight path? And if they cannot establish radio contact, then they will immediately scramble an interceptor, a military jet. They'll contact the military, the Pentagon, and they will say, this particular flight number is doing this, it's off its flight path, we can't contact them, we need to find out what's going on. And the only way to find out what's going on is simply to go up there. So they send a military jet, which will go and go up to the plane and see what's going on and inspect. And they will try to communicate with the craft via various wingtip movements, etc. And obviously the whole situation takes on a new scale if it's a hijack situation, which obviously is a case of there are actually measures in place, which if you look at the manuals, which talk about how planes can actually be forced to actually move in various ways by a number of, if you put a number of jets in the air, you can actually force a plane to fly and to change its course, basically. And those measures, basically, none of these basic procedures which are there, which are followed through all the time, every single day, in relation to normal kind of air emergencies which occur. None of this took place on 9/11. And you mentioned the behavior of Richard B. Myers, and I should basically say that Richard Myers came out and he was talking to the Senate, basically, on the 13th of September, I think it was, and he said that people were asking him in the Senate, why did we fail so drastically to do anything on 9/11? We've got the best air force in the world, and we weren't able to stop what happened. And what happened? And Richard Myers simply said that, well, my crisis action team was up after the first World Trade Center attack occurred, but we didn't scramble planes until after the Pentagon was hit. Which basically means, if we translate that they knew about the crisis at least as early as the first World Trade Center attack. But they didn't do anything about it until after the Pentagon was hit, which is extraordinary, because that's a period of like I said before, about one and a quarter hours, 1.5 hours, and for you to have that kind of failure, it hasn't ever happened before in the history of the United States, and it really does indicate that something somewhere has gone wrong. And yet we find that these procedures, which must be adhered to as a compulsory thing, were not adhered to at all. And Richard Myers was saying this, and the Senate didn't even ask him, why? Why did you fail so badly? This is extraordinary. And in my opinion, if we look at this issue carefully, we can actually establish that there was a chain of command, and that there were actually most probably stand-down orders given. One good reason for believing that is actually the testimony of Dick Cheney, Vice President, who came on NBC, I think it was on 15th September, just not long after the attack at all, and he was talking about what happened on 9/11 with the guy who was interviewing him, just the whole thing, how he experienced it, what happened, what he did, what he didn't do. And one of the things he said was that, again, the guy asked him about the failure to scramble planes, and he asked him about, you know, isn't it true that we didn't manage to scramble planes in time to rescue the Pentagon? What, you know, why? And then basically he simply said, you know, the decision to scramble aircraft is a presidential level decision. It was made by the White House, and we didn't know what to do. We weren't sure what to do in that situation. We didn't want to think about shooting down an aircraft or anything like that. Because of the concept of shooting down an aircraft, it was too much for us to take. So, you know, we were confused about it. And it's essentially what he said. But disregarding all the other excuses he made about being scared of shooting down a civilian aircraft, which was not the only option I had, and is also superfluous to the issue of actually scrambling an aircraft in the first place and seeing what's going on up there, we should focus on his testimony that the decision to scramble aircraft was a presidential level decision.
That was Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, executive director of the British-based Institute for Policy Development Research. His book, The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked on September 11, is an effort to explore the many strange incidents that took place in the United States and around the world leading up to 9/11. You can reach Nafees Ahmed on his website, www.globalresearch.org. That's globalresearch.org. He was interviewed by Jeffrey Blankfort, journalist and broadcaster, on his program Takes on the World on KZYX in Philo, California. This is part one of a two-part program. In the next broadcast, you will hear about the background of the so-called lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, and the question, was this done on purpose in order to prepare war, first on Afghanistan and now Iraq? I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on the War on Freedom on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program on the War on Freedom by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.